We've spoken a lot about stroke on MRAP in the last few years. We've talked about the use of TPA or not TPA. We've talked about stroke centres. We've talked about scoring systems. We've talked about a lot of things. And recently we've started to talk about interventional radiology therapies for the treatment of stroke. Are they better than things like TPA, even if you're not a TPA believer? Well, initially these studies were really negative. Initially, the study said interventions with special devices that suck the clot out are no better than standard therapy with things like TPA. But the tide has changed. In the last year or so, there's been a number of large trials that have re-examined this with a specific subset of patients. But I get ahead of myself. David Newman, who needs no introduction, is going to go into this in some detail. He's going to do one of his famous deep dives and ask the question, in whom might interventional therapies for acute stroke work? And in the end, how many patients are we really talking about?
Hello, MRAP Nation. David Newman here, the NNT.com et al. Boy, holy smokes, we have a tinderbox here waiting to blow. As you all know, I am sure, the last few months have seen an explosion. Three randomized trials of endovascular therapies for acute ischemic stroke. And there is a lot to talk about. And I want to try and do this in a reasonable amount of time. I have to tell you, it is against every instinct I have as a sort of a super dork. I want to talk about this for hours. I want to go over this in excruciating, painful, agonizingly boring detail. And, you know, of course, there are people who are already doing this. I have already done this, you know, with the randomized trials that we're going to talk about today. And there are people who you should pay attention to in addition, obviously, over the next couple months to years, we're going to be gelling our understanding in the emergency medicine discipline, our understanding of these trials and what they mean, and whether they're a sea change or not, because that's sort of the big question for today. And there's a lot of voices to listen to. There's already people putting out great stuff on this. Ryan Radesky, emlitofnote.com, emnerd.com, Rory Spiegel, doing great work and writing great stuff about this already. So keep your ear to the ground on this. There's more to come. What I'm going to do is give you a brief overview of what these randomized trials are and what they seem to suggest. We'll do a little brief overview of context and then the trials themselves, and then a little bit of an interpretive dance. So here we go. Let's jump right in. First of all, what is the context for all of this? The context for all of this is reperfusion therapy for acute ischemic stroke. In 1995, as you may recall, there was this little study, and it was called NINS. And we had a big problem with NINS because it put us in a box. NINS was a single trial out of a dozen major randomized trials on the topic of reperfusion therapy for acute ischemic stroke. It suggested a benefit, that one trial. 10 of the other major 12 trials did not suggest a benefit. And we've been arguing back and forth about whether or not thrombolytics can be beneficial for ischemic stroke or not for the last 20 years since then. What we have now is a new question. Reperfusion therapy in the form of stenting, vacuum sucking out the clot, doing endovascular therapies for ischemic stroke. We all know that for coronary occlusion, that did seem to be a better step. So thrombolytics for acute coronary occlusion were pretty good. There were 60,000 people in randomized major trials that seemed to suggest there was a significant benefit. And we later learned that endovascular therapy, coronary catheterization, and stenting, angioplasty, etc., was a little bit better. It was even better than just doing thrombolytics. The question is that the case for stroke? Now, since I've alluded to it, we have to give you this context as well. I feel I must point out that there were 60,000 people in coronary occlusion randomized controlled trials, major randomized trials of 1,000 persons or more in each of the major trials. Every single one of those trials yielded a mortality benefit, every single one of them. Ultimately, we were able to find out from those 60,000 people that it was the ST elevations where people actually benefited from opening the artery. It was not ST depressions, and it was not normal EKGs. Those patients actually died more often. But we didn't know that until we had 60,000 people side by side, and we could do the subgroup analysis that allowed us to figure out that actually that was the group that benefited. So it's ST elevations, and we know that now. We take it for granted. But we didn't know that back in the day, and it took the 60,000 people. Part of what we're doing as we build a new database for stroke patients is trying to aggregate enough people that we can figure out who it is who truly benefits. So I have believed for many years now that there is a small group somewhere, even with thrombolytics, who may benefit from getting that therapy with ischemic stroke. But there seem to be just as many people who are killed or harmed by getting that therapy. And what we've been trying to figure out as we aggregate new data is who it is that gets the benefit and who it is that gets the harm. Because if you don't know, then you're not talking about an overall beneficial therapy. And that's what we've been arguing about and trying to figure out for years, I think, is who it is that might actually benefit from this therapy. With that context in mind, there have been three major endovascular randomized controlled trials, not just in the last 3 months, but there were three published in 2013. And this is an important backdrop to reviewing the trials for today. There were three published in 2013, MR Rescue, IMS3, and Synthesis. And those three trials did not find a benefit, even though they were like designed and methodologically built to show a benefit by people who believed there was a benefit. They were sure, the people who designed every one of those trials were pretty sure they were going to find a huge benefit to endovascular therapy for ischemic stroke patients, and none of those trials found a benefit. That's important. Now, to get us up to speed and bring us up to the present day, we now are looking at three new randomized controlled trials. Forget the ones from 2013. New randomized controlled trials, MR Clean, Extend-IA, and Escape. MR Clean was published in December, this most recent December, 2014. Extend-IA and Escape were published online just in the last 2 weeks in the New England Journal of Medicine. Let's talk about these three trials. First of all, there's a couple things that are common to all of them. Overwhelmingly, the patients who got into these endovascular therapy trials were patients who had tPA already. This is really, really important because what we have done with this new data is to figure out who already got tPA seems to be a good candidate for endovascular therapy. These studies ranged from 70, 75% up to 100% of their subjects had tPA before they then got the endovascular therapy. That is critically important because it's all about selection, right? And this is a very, very select group. We already know it's an incredibly select group who gets thrombolytics. It's hard to find patients who get thrombolytics. It's, you know, something like 1 in 8 to 1 in 10, even in the stroke centers that are doing a lot of thrombolytics. So if it's 1 or 8 and 1 in 10, then after you've chosen somebody who's a potential tPA candidate, you can consider the endovascular therapies if what you're doing is trying to match your patient to randomized trial data. So these are patients overwhelmingly who got tPA. They were all, in all three trials, patients who had large vessel occlusions. You could not get into any one of the three trials that I'm about to tell you about unless you had a major MCA stroke, an internal carotid artery occlusion, or an anterior circulation, anterior cerebral artery stroke in one of the major branch vessels. So, large vessel occlusions. The final thing to know about these three trials is that two of them used newer techniques to figure out who had an ischemic penumbra and who had a small infarcted core. We'll talk about that again in a minute. Let's hit the trials now. Our first trial is the one that made big news in December of 2014 when it came out. It's called the MR Clean trial. It was done in the Netherlands. It's 16 different centers, all well-known stroke centers, all centers that had a lot of experience with endovascular therapies. It was an industry-supported, non-blinded treatment trial, right? Like I said, no sham therapies here. It was all non-blinded, so the patients and the doctors knew which group that they were in. Usual care versus usual care plus endovascular therapy. That's what the two groups were randomized to. Clinical strokes, that's who got in. You had to have a clinical stroke with a proximal occlusion. Internal carotid artery, MCA, or anterior cerebral artery at the sort of branch major vessels, so large vessel occlusion proven by imaging, and you had to come in the first 0 to 6 hours. Primary outcome was neurologic status at 90 days, and here's how this study's results broke down. It was mid to late 60s. That's the age group that got in. That was the median age was 66. The NIH stroke scale was 17. It was about 4 hours and 20 minutes between stroke onset and puncture of the groin. 500 people were randomized in this trial. 500. The independent at 90 days marker, the marker we care about, independent at 90 days, and I'm using modified Rankine scale of 0 to 2 because I think it's probably the most translatable and easy outcome to use, and it's there and reported in all three of the trials. So modified Rankine scale 0 to 2, independent at 90 days, 33% in the group that got the endovascular therapy, 19% in the group that got usual care without endovascular therapy. That's a 14% difference with a number needed to treat of 7. Now, 6% of patients had complications, and I mean, I have to say, Mr. Clean is notable for a million reasons, but if I'm only going to say a few things, you got to mention that there were terrible outcomes in this study, just terrible outcomes. I mean, 33% were independent at 90 days. That's awful. Two-thirds were dependent or dead at 90 days, and this is a group where in the control group, only 19% were independent at 90 days. So if you didn't get the endovascular therapy, 80% of people were not independent at 90 days. This is a bunch of very, very sick stroke patients. Okay, that's Mr. Clean, 14% benefit. Extend IA. This is Australia, New Zealand, 14 different centers. They enrolled over 24 months or so. Industry supported, again, non-blinded treatment, usual care versus usual care plus endovascular therapy. It was clinical strokes with a proximal occlusion. Again, by imaging, you had to see a proximal occlusion, distal ICA, the internal carotid, or MCA. They also did a CT perfusion scan where they looked to see if they could identify only those patients who had a definite ischemic penumbra around a small infarcted core. So they did a CT perfusion scan that proved that the patient had a large area that was still getting some trickle flow that was much larger than the dead already ischemic core where that patient had already stroked out and there was no recovery of tissue. So a larger area that was getting some perfusion and could be reperfused, that was the only patient who got into this trial, and that's different from Mr. Clean. Mr. Clean, they did not use that as an inclusion criteria, so you didn't have to prove that it was a small core with a large area of potentially at-risk tissue that could still be saved. So this Australian-New Zealand trial, what were the results? The median age was 69. The NIH stroke scale was 15, so a little bit better than the Mr. Clean folks at the beginning. And stroke to puncture time was a little bit quicker. It was about 3.5 hours, different from the Mr. Clean folks where it was 4 hours and 20 minutes, right? So 3.5 hours from stroke to actual puncture. Modified Rankine scale, 0 to 2, independent at 90 days. This group, 72 versus 39%. This is a 33% difference in independent at 90 days. Now, I'm not sure I mentioned there was only 70 people in this trial. So it was stopped early, this trial. They planned on having 100 people. They stopped it at 70. Why? Because they saw the data from Mr. Clean and they said, oh, we're going to stop it early. There's all kinds of methodology issues that we could talk about related to that. I'm not going to get into the weeds. I will just say 70 people stopped early and the benefit was 33% absolute. In the endovascular group, there was a 72% chance that you were going to be independent at 90 days. In the usual care group, 39%. Note that that is wildly different from the Mr. Clean trial, where it was 33 and 19. This is 72 and 39. These guys had lower stroke scores, fewer internal carotid artery occlusions. They did way better overall. Now, that benefit of 33%, that translates into a number needed to treat of 3. It's a number needed to treat of 3. This is totally unheard of, absolutely unprecedented. A third of people saw the benefit where they shifted to independent at 90 days in this trial. Now, this trial is small. It was stopped early. It's non-blinded. There's a variety of reasons why there might have been such a big benefit. And so it seems like it might be too good to be true. But that's what they claim. Extend IA is claiming a 33% absolute benefit. Notably, 6% complications, just like Mr. Clean, but obviously way better outcomes than Mr. Clean, both in terms of the benefit, but also in terms of the control group was, you know, way more likely to be independent at 90 days. So moving on, ESCAPE, the third trial to talk about. ESCAPE, This one was done 22 centers in Canada, the US, South Korea, Ireland, UK, over about 20 months. This one was also industry funded, also non-blinded, no sham group, also usual care versus usual care plus endovascular, and in this case, only about 3/4 of the patients got TPA. 1/4 of the patients actually just went straight to the endovascular, but 3/4 of them got TPA. Again, it was clinical strokes, proximal occlusions in the anterior circulation, either ACA or MCA. They could have internal carotid, all proven by imaging. And again, they proved that these patients had some collateral flow to an area of an ischemic penumbra with a dead core. So there was a dead core that was small, but an ischemic penumbra where they had clear trickle flow of some sort. And they showed with CT angiography in this study that they wouldn't allow anybody into the trial unless indeed they had some flow going to the area that was at risk for becoming part of the larger dead core. They enrolled patients 0 to 12 hours in this group. This study enrolled up to 12 hours. They were so confident that they were selecting the right group based on their CT angiography criteria, where they had to show a large vessel occlusion and also had to show that there was a small core with a large at-risk territory of tissue. They were so confident in that that they enrolled up to 12 hours. Again, their primary outcome was the 90-day neurologic status, and they had a huge emphasis in escape. Huge emphasis on trying to sort of address and fix what had gone wrong in the previous 3 major randomized trials that didn't show benefits. There's a whole list in that study's supplement that you can look at to try and figure out how it is and why it is that they might have been different than the previous 3 trials. What were their results? Median age of 70, an IH stroke scale of 17, exactly the same as Mr. Clean. Their stroke to balloon time was about 4 hours. So again, stroke to puncture in the 3.5 hour range. They enrolled 315 patients, and this was another one where they stopped early. In both the ESCAPE trial and Extend IA, they stopped early because they saw Mr. Clean. And in both cases, they saw a benefit, so they just stopped enrollment, closed enrollment of the trial. In this trial, 315 subjects. They had planned more, but they stopped early. And the difference between the treatment and the control group for modified Rankin scale of 0 to 2 was 53 versus 29%. That's a 24% difference. Again, an almost unprecedented difference, 24%. That's a number needed to treat of 4. 1 in 4 people were shifted to being independent at 90 days, according to this study. One other thing that's notable about the ESCAPE trial, they reduced mortality from 13 to 6%. And this is the first time any randomized controlled trial has actually shown a mortality benefit to reperfusion for ischemic stroke. So 13 versus 6%, which is a number needed to treat of 15 to save a life using endovascular therapy. Massive treatment effect. This is 24 friggin' percent. That's a massive effect. So number needed to treat of 4, what do you say about that massive effect? Well, okay, let's look at all 3 trials now. And again, by the way, again, it was 6% complications in this ESCAPE group. So the complications across the board were 6% in almost every single trial. So there are people who are going to be harmed or have complications based on this endovascular therapy, but it's obviously much smaller than the benefits that are being claimed by all 3 of these studies. Let's just overview here. 3 randomized controlled trials, one of 500 people, one of 70 people, one of 315 people. Those 3 randomized controlled trials showed a 14, 33, and 24% absolute benefit. One of the things that's different about those 3 trials, or that's different within them, is that Mr. Clean had really bad outcomes. Really bad outcomes. In the ESCAPE trial, 29%, 30% were independent at 90 days. So that's closer to Mr. Clean, but it's not as good as the Extend IA cohort, where they actually had in the control group 40% of their patients were independent at 90 days. So, I mean, they're different. These 3 trials are clearly different, and they clearly enrolled slightly different people. I can't explain why Mr. Clean was so bad, but it is notable that Mr. Clean was the study of the 3 that didn't prove definitively that the patient had a small infarcted core and a large at-risk ischemic penumbra that seemed to be available for reperfusion and saving. That is notable. So these 3 trials, what do we think overall? Well, I think personally that these 3 randomized trials are very promising. I think they're promising. I don't think they've proven beyond all shadow of a doubt that these therapies are clearly therapies that we can deploy in exactly the way they're describing. But I think they're very promising. Listen, we have three randomized trials that were done by, you know, some of the same groups of people that didn't show a benefit. Now we have three randomized trials that did show a benefit. Those three randomized trials that did show a benefit showed much bigger benefits than I think anybody expected. Why would that be? Well, there's a variety of reasons that might be. One thing we've already mentioned, which is these are non-blinded trials. There's no sham group. So it could be that the effect is being exaggerated by that. And all of the methodological literature about blinding versus non-blinding would suggest that, yeah, there's at least some effect of that. And it also suggests that when there was no benefit that was actually found in the three randomized trials published in 2013, actually there was a significant harm that was being masked. It wasn't just that there was no benefit. There was probably a substantial harm. But now these three trials show a significant benefit, and it's probably exaggerated by the fact that two of them were stopped early and by this non-blinding issue. You know, when the patient knows exactly what treatment they got, they may be a little bit more excited to report, you know, recovery in certain ways. And a lot of the data collection here was reporting of recovery by the patient. So those two things might exaggerate the effect. That said, these effect sizes are massive. These are really impressive effect sizes. And I think what it probably suggests is that we've been trying to figure out for years, like I said at the beginning, who are the patients who probably get the benefit of reperfusion therapy and who are the ones that we harm. I think there's a strong suggestion here, particularly from the extend and escape trials, that we may have really started to figure out who gets the benefit. It could be these patients who have a small infarcted core and a large at-risk ischemic penumbra that is clear and obvious on the imaging. Now, that select group of people may really get the benefit from reperfusion therapy. And again, I do believe that that is likely based on at least these two trials, Extend and Escape. Mr. Clean's a little bit more tenuous to me, but Extend and Escape are pretty convincing. Here's what I think that means in general and more broadly for the treatment of acute ischemic stroke. I think it means that selection is what's really important. This is a critical concept for a variety of reasons, but it is notable that if you go to the Mr. Clean data and you look at how many people got enrolled in these centers, these major stroke centers where they're constantly looking for patients who might be relevant and appropriate and have indications for endovascular therapy, they were able to enroll in the Netherlands, in Mr. Clean, 1.3 patients per center per month. In the Extend IA trial, they enrolled 0.2 patients per center per month. In the Escape trial, they enrolled 1.4 patients per center per month. Overall, we're talking about a max of about a patient per center per month. That actually makes sense to me. It makes sense to me that if you're looking for just the right people who really are going to benefit from reperfusion therapy with endovascular or pretty much any kind of therapy, it is probably very, very few people. And I think what they did differently here with these new randomized trials, if we are to believe that there really is a benefit, I think what they've probably done is selected out the group who really gets the benefit. It took 60,000 people in trials of MI to figure out who really got the benefit. We've only got a couple thousand people in these randomized trials so far for endovascular therapy, but it looks like we're narrowing down to that group that really gets the benefit. And boy, I gotta say, it is incredibly few people. It is guaranteed that these centers saw many, many, many stroke patients that they passed up. And actually, only one of the trials documented exactly who they excluded and who they included and what those numbers looked like. The Mr. Clean and the Escape trials did not report who they included and excluded. They didn't track that, which is a real downside, an important downside, because it would be important to see that. But in the Extend IA trial, they did tell us exactly who they excluded and included, and it's remarkable, because what it shows in the flowchart is that they had about 8,000 people who had ischemic strokes. Only about 1,000 of them got TPA, and then only 70 people were randomized to the endovascular versus not endovascular therapy group. That is 1 in 100 people who they saw with acute ischemic stroke. 1 in 100. That's incredible. And I think it tells you a lot about how it might be that they found a benefit. They narrowed down. Narrow, narrow, narrow. From every step, they got more and more select and found exactly the patients who might benefit. So when we talk about what this means and what the ramifications are, I do believe that there's a good chance that there was a significant benefit here from the endovascular therapies. But it is very clear, it is crystal clear, that there are very, very few people who this is going to be relevant to. And I think probably one of our greatest fears, certainly it was one of our greatest fears that came true with thrombolytics for ischemic stroke, was that they were going to start making indications for people who had nothing to do with the original trial, who had nothing to do even with the NINS criteria suggested. And when they did that, I think it made us all nuts. Listen, it's irritating to have a trial that you don't believe in and have a whole other set of trials that everybody's ignoring on thrombolytics for stroke because it's convenient and they don't want to believe that the answer might be null rather than a true benefit. That's annoying and irritating and difficult to deal with, and it might hurt some people. But it is totally maddening when they start taking a trial that certainly was very questionable to begin with and expanding the indications beyond that group, which is what's happened for thrombolytic therapy. What I'm afraid of with this endovascular therapy is the same thing. I'm afraid that what's going to happen now is all these patients in the 0 to 6, 0 to 12 hour ranges are going to start getting scooped up and taken for endovascular therapy, despite the fact that they do not fit the criteria of having a dead little core of tissue and a large ischemic penumbra and a clear large vessel occlusion and a clear, not improving clinically, major stroke. So when you take only those patients, it looks like there might be a benefit. Those patients are uncommon. So maybe the most important thing for us to remember here as we watch the culture around us start to sort of exhibit a real sea change. This is going to be a massive tectonic shift, man. Our endovascular colleagues are going to really go nuts saying, we found a benefit, we found a benefit, we found a benefit. As far as I'm concerned, they're probably right. They did find a benefit. But the reason that they found a benefit was because they plucked out very uncommon patients. And if we keep them to that, if we are able to be very honest about where there's benefit and where there's not, this is the group that we have to exclusively use the endovascular therapies on. Now, I'm going to point one other thing out, which is, at least based on my own read of these studies, I would love to see a study using these selection criteria for who gets thrombolytics. Forget who gets endovascular therapy. We ought to be using these imaging techniques to figure out who gets thrombolytics. Use the little dead core with a large ischemic penumbra based on CT angiography showing clear collateral flow to the area that's at risk. It's still alive. It's at risk, but it's still alive. Use that selection criterion to actually decide who gets thrombolytics. And then you might figure out who really benefits from thrombolytics. I mean, thrombolysis is essentially a failed therapy. We have one randomized trial that showed a benefit that nobody's ever been able to really replicate. Now what we need to do is start using this kind of imaging technology to figure out who the right patients are who might really get that benefit. I'm going to give one more shout out here about these data. I spoke with Jerry Hoffman about this. And Jerry, as everybody knows, is a real skeptic. He's a profound skeptic when it comes to this and anything else. He thinks that the outcomes in these trials look terrible, particularly in the control groups, and he's not sure he believes it. And I don't blame him at all. And he quoted to me the parable of the unicorn, something that he has published about in the past. And it is just the idea that essentially we've been watching the stroke neurologists cry wolf for so many years. They've been saying, no, benefit, benefit, benefit for so many years that when we actually find a therapy where there really is truly a benefit, it's kind of hard to believe them. It's kind of hard to believe that they actually finally found the unicorn. And I think that that's a lot of what people are feeling about these data. They're feeling like, I don't know, there's been so much subterfuge for so long. There's been so much deception for so long about all this stuff. Why would I believe it now? And I understand that. I think that that point is a very reasonable, logical point. So, although I do believe that these trials showed a benefit, to me, it's about selection. And I think we're going to need to be really careful over the next 10, 15 years trying to figure out if we are going to be able to do this right. And the way to do this right is to use the selection criteria that they used in the randomized controlled trials that showed the largest benefits. Use those selection criteria to determine who gets endovascular therapy. And that, I would imagine, is going to be a bit of a struggle. So there's one person's take on the three new randomized trials of endovascular therapy for stroke. There's promise out there for very few, but there does seem to be some real promise for acute ischemic stroke therapies.
All right, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Dave Newman's take that in a super select subgroup of patients where they've got a proximal lesion and they've got a big ischemic penumbra and you've looked at it with some extra special imaging technologies, you can select out a group of patients that will do very well from this. But at the biggest centers, at the brighter centers, where the most aggressive neurologists are, they're only doing this once or twice a month. And so although this is an important advance for the majority of people and for the majority of hospitals, this isn't that important. But what is important, what is incredibly important, is the concept of indication creep. That because you're a good and fine neurologist, this therapy works so well in this group, surely it's also going to work in this patient in front of me who doesn't quite fit the same criteria. And over time, you get this creep of the indications until you're really giving it to people where it doesn't work. And it's all harm, no benefit, or all expense, no benefit. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the real concern. And unfortunately, in the House of Medicine, we do that all the time. Not because we are bad people, but because we are humans. So beware of indication creep.